surround myself with people who continue to get more out of you. So thank you for that. It doesn't matter what you've achieved, and there's always somebody who can squeeze more out of you, and you can always do more what you think you can.
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast with myself, Ryan Walker. In this episode, we're looking at the journey through critical care in the UK with Tom Archer and Mike Palmer. What I wanted to do in the conversation is examine the current climate of critical care within the UK and unpack how that looks and the journey of where it's come from. So we're going to look at the anatomy of competency portfolios, the journey towards an MSc established program, interventions and drugs versus critical thinking, and much more. So to do this, I have Tom Archer and Mike Palmer with me. Tom started his career in the ambulance service in London in 2004 before moving to Wales in 2010. So he predominantly worked in central London as a paramedic, as a fast response paramedic, and now as a retrieval practitioner in critical care with EMRTS in Wales, so the Welsh Air Ambulance. Mike Palmer qualified in the London Ambulance Service as a paramedic and then specialised in the hazardous area response team before becoming a flight paramedic on London's Air Ambulance. And he now flies as a critical care paramedic for EMRTS in Wales. Welcome both to the podcast.
Morning. Thank you, Owen.
Hi, Owen. Yeah, great. Yeah, finally back on the podcast now. So it's been a long time coming.
I'd just like to start, if possible, with yourself, Tom, and just if you could just speak to some of the major changes that we've seen in paramedic practice since the early 2000s and the, sort of the evolution of practice within the UK, how it looks now to how it looked then.
Yeah, well, kind of we started our journey kind of at a similar time, and we're kind of doing the BSc honours degree for undergraduate, and we're probably some of the earlier kind of members on that course as it was kind of evolving. And so I think we've kind of seen that professional evolution over the last kind of two decades of kind of practice. And it's quite interesting because there's the educational element to it, but then there's the kind of more global aspect, if you look in terms of paramedicine and how that kind of factors in. I think we're becoming more multidisciplinary. So we have people from mental health background, kind of working in the control centres. You've got kind of more pathways for patients as we look to take, you know, the patient to the appropriate point of care, especially given some of the pressures on our system at the moment in the NHS, which I think for the last kind of 3-4 years has been quite significant to our kind of cohort of pre-hospital practitioners. In terms of in Wales, if you kind of look from 2010 to where we are now, we've seen the evolution of certainly from the air ambulance perspective and critical care with the EMRTS coming into fruition. So it's a consultant-led team providing kind of intensive care, emergency kind of medicine, care at point of contact. So it's always kind of described taking the hospital to the patient. And the teams that we kind of work in, they're very much flattened hierarchy with kind of practitioners and doctors at the same time. Everyone brings their little piece to the team. And for me, certainly, it's a really enjoyable service to work for in that respect. In terms of education, masters are becoming the norm now, really. I think next will kind of be PhDs and where they sit within this kind of service and scope of kind of practice for how we look at governance within our systems as paramedics and not necessarily need that medical oversight. We've got consultant paramedics now in post in certain services who are the leads for governance and kind of underwrite some of the kind of directives and kind of scope that staff have.
I just wondered, Mike, if you could just speak to how critical care has changed within this time, because I fundamentally agree with everything Tom's saying around there's just this been evolution of higher education and indeed master's level and then indeed PhD level. Could you maybe speak to who the custodians of critical care were sort of 10, 15, 20 years ago and how maybe that's changed over time?
Yeah, I think it's just to echo what Tom was saying really there is, you know, if you go to, I urge listeners to go to paramedicphd.com, makes an interesting read, but there's dozens and dozens of PhDs on there with paramedic kind of backgrounds. You know, one paramedic, Tim Edwards, you know him from London days, really, that, you know, previous London Hems paramedic, now consultant paramedic in London, did his thesis on airway management in Ross Care with STEMI patients and their neurological outcomes. And he found that there's no differences between subglottic and endotracheal in cardiac arrest. So the PhD kind of level of education now, but going back down to, you know, years and years ago when yourselves that did the first paramedic degree, now to get onto the register for the Healthcare Professions Council, you have to have a bachelor degree or equivalent, and that was launched just after COVID in 2021. So I think how education has changed our systems and how it's going, I think that's really kind of governed where we're going as a profession. And it was great, Owen, the other day that you had Vicky Brown on. And I think, you know, individuals like that, so you've got, you know, Vicky Brown over at Great Western Air Ambulance, GWAC, and you've got Neil Flowers, who is, again, over at East Anglia, so EAAA. They now both consultants in pre-hospital emergency medicine, FEM, through the Royal College of Edinburgh. So they've done the fellowship, so the FIMC. And I think more people that do that, and, you know, the way that, you know, we're going as a profession, I think that's absolutely fantastic, really. So that's more kind of, you know, like the education side, but then we've got our College of Paramedics. Interesting, this year we've got a newly appointed Carl Smith, who's now head of the development and, yeah, emergency critical care for the college from paramedics. I think, you know, from my point of view, I think over recent years there's been a lot of drive with urgent care, which has been, you know, in a lot of, you know, the majority, actually, you know, all 999 calls sometimes are urgent care by basis. And, you know, maybe some people might think that critical care had been a bit on the back burner, but now having Carl appointed, you know, hopefully that his experience with other air ambulances around the UK, MAGPAS, EAAA, and hopefully kind of bring something to the college and the profession as well.
No, that's fantastic, Mike. And as you were saying, there's been a lot more of investment within critical care, within the ambulance service, from, like you said, leadership appointments, but also the integration of, I think, critical care from what would be archetypal air ambulances actually into the ambulance service itself. So there are programs within Scotland, London, I believe within Bristol, and indeed west of England now, and indeed up and down the country. So NWAS in Manchester and others around the country, whereby there is a certain level of governance and indeed critical care embedded within the ambulance service now. So historically used to be only air ambulance charities, but now we're seeing the evolution of this, the advanced paramedic practice schemes, but like you said, spearheaded by consultant paramedics, which have got an amazing portfolio of PhDs and masters. And then again, like you said, prerequisite of master's level trained, educated clinicians at that level. So the forefront of that innovation is critical thinking, and indeed high performing individuals at level seven, but embedded within the ambulance service. And so, Tom, could you maybe speak to indeed the prerequisite for an MSc now within paramedic practice, what that enables from a professional practice perspective, and indeed from maybe a governance perspective?
Yeah, well, I've been kind of lucky over the last 6 years. I've taught for postgraduate medicine at the School of Medicine in Cardiff University, and look at the critical care masters and kind of taught on that. So I do keep kind of my eye on terms of where that fits in the landscape of kind of professional practice. Kind of our masters is very, I would say, academically based. And so it's multidisciplinary, it's online, so it's asynchronous, which also makes it international, which is really quite interesting, because I know you're out in Canada and I've got some kind of past students and colleagues now who are kind of honorary lecturers on the course, which is really kind of quite quite cool. Having that kind of looking at others, you know, what's happening in Canada, what's happening in South Africa, what's happening in Australia, and indeed many other countries. Now, in terms of applying for managerial posts, in terms of advanced practice posts, the MSc is the prerequisite to kind of come into practice. What's interesting then is, you know, the needs of organisations as well. So I know that some organisations would look at a master's, which is academic like ours, with regards to looking at the research and coming up with assignments on specific topics, whether that be cardiovascular, respiratory. Whereas I think some organisations want to have that portfolio alongside the master's as well, which is something we can't do because we're multidisciplinary. So we have consultants in emergency medicine. We have senior sisters from ITU. We have a number of paramedics from various backgrounds. We have physios, we have nutritionists, because they've all got this interest in critical care patients, and that they have the autonomy then to look at the specific areas that they find kind of interesting. Which goes more along in kind of building up that research career and looking to see what are the areas that kind of we are unsure about in terms of the evidence or need kind of more robust guidelines. And I think, you know, that's then useful to put into organizations. So you have people then querying their practice as they see it in terms of at a local level. You know, we kind of know research in terms of external validity doesn't fit everything, doesn't fit all services. And that's really good because, you know, data governance is what organizations need to look at. And to be able to look at that in, you know, a quantitative perspective, then having that building block of an MSc behind you in terms of understanding evidence-based practice, research principles, etc., allows then for that data to be used meaningfully. And then that can be shared across a number of different stakeholders, whether that be at kind of government level, whether it be local level, kind of clinical level, whether it's at commissioning level. And the commissioning level is quite important because, you know, prudent healthcare at the moment, it's, you know, certainly a topic which is very much at the forefront of our health system at the moment. So yeah, it is that continuing evolution as to where we kind of go as a profession.
So Mike, just looking at the progressive sort of realization of non-technical skills and human factors within critical care, it seems to have become more commonplace to shine a light on these non-technical skills. And just to Tom's point there around the importance of level 7 education across the spectrum, we're very much seeing human factors become even a level 7 modules within master's programs to emphasize the need for strong non-technical skills and human factors education. Could you maybe speak to sort of the importance and spotlight of non-technical skills and human factors within critical care?
Yeah, no, you know, definitely. And, you know, you said it quite rightly that, you know, most undergraduate, postgraduate, you know, have got human factors and FEM, you know, with their learner outcomes, with the whole modules, some are even, you know, to that aspect. And you didn't mention everywhere else, you know, you've got the conferences, you've got the, you know, the journals, academic papers. So it's pretty much out there now. It's all these kind of like the buzzwords that's always going to get passed around. So there's always growing awareness of, you know, that essentially that, you know, some adverse events are often caused by problems with non-technical skills than, you know, more than lack of technical expertise. For example, a non-technical skills, you know, task management, you know, you've got your teamwork, situational awareness, leadership. You know, on every critical care job that, you know, yourself or, you know, I do, Tom does, we'll be able to comment on some aspect of these examples. You know, teamwork, you know, that could be in with your own team as critical care, that could be within the ambulance service, or then integrating both teams together. You know, task management, you know, those lots of little tasks needs to be performed before a big task is performed. For example, prepping for somebody for an anesthetic, for example. Situational awareness, I think we're all kind of aware of that sometimes, or maybe not aware of it sometimes, really. But we know that, you know, your listening goes first. And then sometimes I don't do it intentionally, really, but somebody might ask me something while I'm doing something else. And then I'm quite acutely aware sometimes that I haven't responded to them. But being aware that, you know, that happens, you know, knowing, you know, little things that, you know, if I keep asking for somebody's name for the third or fourth time, I know that, you know, I'm getting pretty filled up really. And I've, you know, knowing to have some time out, offload to somebody else. But learning the art of delegation, when to delegate, when not to delegate. You know, you can ask some people to help you out sometimes, and it can go really well. But then sometimes you're not quite aware of, you know, the team's kind of level of experience or exposure to some certain aspects of our job. And picking your time for, like, you know, value added comms, knowing where the risk areas are, and it all kind of boils down to really to delivering kind of good patient care in a timely, effective manner, really. So yeah, going back to like the education side. Bring it back to our kind of day job, really.
So, Tom, could you speak to the four pillars of advanced practice that the College of Paramedics posited and indeed put forward in 2018?
Yeah, so it's kind of part of the career kind of framework, and you've got clinical practice, education, leadership and management, and research as the kind of four pillars. And so I think, you know, that's something that was needed so that people could look at the different career pathways and interests and strengths that people have in regards to how to kind of progress. I think that's really important at the moment. I think as a profession, seeing new paramedics come out and having a high turnover rate is going to be frustrating for everybody involved, you know, going through that education kind of BSE level and, you know, student debt and things like that, coming out into a service whereby there's kind of pressures, kind of high work demands. To have that investment and have them leave early, I think can put, you know, services in the healthcare sector in general in crisis. And we're seeing that. And it'd be interesting now to see the workforce plan that's just about to come out from the NHS and from government, and what they're going to do in terms of investment into the next 15 years. And, you know, that was similar to the police. We saw police numbers come down, and then they've had a huge kind of recruitment kind of period over the last kind of few years. And I think we're recognizing in health that's what we need. And so that career satisfaction is quite important. And those kind of four pillars are an enabler to that, really. And I think, you know, that's the importance for the likes of you and me. But otherwise, we're going to lose people to other professions. We're going to lose them maybe within health, but they're going to be lost to the ambulance service. And so it really is key. It's kind of, how do we look after staff? How do we look after that in terms of career progression? So, yeah, I think it's an important part of kind of human resources, workforce kind of planning. In regards to paramedicine.
So Mike, you were just saying actually about this human factors piece, and you were saying, you know, just the art of learning how to delegate and also how to craft a scene, but recognizing human factors within yourself. One thing we were speaking about offline actually was just how the integration of some of these important fundamentals on scene have been integrated within higher education and indeed within MSc programs. Could you maybe speak to the MSc program you're on and how some of these core competencies have been integrated within sort of the higher education program to recognize the skill deployment and acquisition that you're practicing on scene?
Yeah, no, definitely. So lucky with my title as a critical care practitioner for EMERTS. You firstly get signed off with your initial training. You do your supernumerary shifts, and after that, then there's an academic component as well as a clinical component, and then that kind of the whole kind of future training now is kind of mapped out in front of me, and then it roughly takes about 3 years. But the academic component is built in line with EMERTS. And the Welshshire Ambulance, as well as Bangor University. It's an MSc in advanced HEMS practice. And with the collaboration of the Air Ambulance and the university, it's combined with kind of distant learning, face-to-face elements with faculty from the EMERTS consultants, as well as the qualified CCPs here in Wales. So the clinical component of the training is both done in hospital placements, as well as during our shifts as well. And there's elements kind of goes forward then and puts all kind of collaborated together with our kind of paramedic or our practitioner, CCP practitioner portfolio. So there's a number of like work-based company assessments. You know, you've got your DOPS, so your direct or observation and practice, your KEXs, your clinical evaluation exercises, case-based assessments and simulations as well. And all that is kind of written up then, and then totally, you know, interrelated, as I said, with the Bangor MSC. Just to name a few, you've got like respiratory support, and then under that title will be manual ventilation, so the use of Mapleton's C and F circuits. Another one would be using art lines, you know, gas sampling, interpretation, techniques, equipment, clinical management, cardiovascular support, the use of inotrope infusions or art line placements and line management. But then all this is kind of put all together then online. We use a website, NHS ePortfolios now. So it's not, you know, on kind of pen and paper, so it's all kind of online, which I'm really pleased about because I don't want to lose anything really. Together with an online clinical log, an airway log, hospital placements, mentor meetings. And then these all kind of sent off to each of our mentors, and that can be signed off and provide feedback. So it's all kind of linked all together, and it's all, you know, for the access and the ease of ePortfolios, it's been a bit of a game changer, really.
And so just looking at the new norms, actually, in the past 20 years, Tom, and, you know, the adage of VL, so video laryngoscopy, and indeed ultrasound within critical care practice, and how that adds to governance as well. So the utility of being able to record an image and evidence an image that the tube was passed through, indeed through the trachea, and the decisions based on ultrasound images retrospectively in case review. Could you maybe speak to how that's changed, and indeed how that's not only changed practice, but changed from a governance perspective?
Yeah, sure. I think you kind of already answered it there with your question in terms of you're able to capture images. You know, you have that evidence there, whether it be for kind of later down the line or for review of kind of practice. There's a lot there. So, you know, new technologies in pre-hospital care. We've come from, you know, the beginnings of a defibrillator being taken out in a car, you know, in the 1960s. To where we are now, whereby the public are the ones who have defibrillators. So you're no longer, you know, a medical team going out with a defibrillator, it's the public who can use it. And you see things in clinical practice all the time kind of come down to point of care. So we all know that, you know, a lot of what we do, if we kind of look at cardiac arrest, it's not us in critical care. It's public, it's family, it's work colleagues, it's random members of the public who start CPR, put a defibrillator on, you know, big strides from where we were in the 1960s to where we are now. Thrombolysis, you know, is only able to be done by cardiologists in kind of CCUs. And also, someone went, actually, well, give it to the ED docs. You know, ED docs are there kind of going, well, we can do this. And then it comes down to kind of paramedic practice. And then all of a sudden, actually, you look at PCI, that comes in, and we know that there's a different way now to look at our patients. And so, yeah, we have all of these extra tools, which is great. But I think, you know, clinical competence and acumen is still the core of what we do. No matter how much toys you throw at us, it's that kind of emotional learning curve that you get after a number of years experience to go big sick, little sick, and then if big sick, what are the causes for, what are the different treatments, where we go, you know, in the next 50 years, next 100 years, who knows. You know, did I think that we'd be, you know, driving around in Teslas and things like that kind of when I first started kind of my career in the ambulance service, you know, electric Mustangs as the RRV? No. You know, we're driving our LDVs. So I think, you know, technology is always going to, you know, come about for various reasons. Artificial intelligence, how that then kind of sits in, you know, decision making and practice. heads-up display, telemedicine. There's all of these things that we're on that kind of, you know, technological revolution in our lifetime. We've kind of been lucky to be part of that period of humanity. So, you know, that there are going to be those Star kind of Trek technologies that come about, I'd say, probably in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time. How that fits into medicine, it will always be about trying to bring the treatment to a patient in the most timely, appropriate manner. And so we have a role in that as paramedics. It'd be an interesting journey. I can't tell you all the things that are on the radar, but I'm sure that kind of many of our listeners will be thinking about those types of things.
Yeah, I fundamentally agree. I think AI and indeed large language models will play a central piece both within human factors mitigation and indeed the way we interact with machines in critical care instances. Absolutely, and it'd be interesting. Mike, could you speak to the governance piece? Just, you know, just maybe just a really small potted version of where governance has come from, where it originated from, into where we are now.
So maybe some listeners from abroad, maybe not in UK, but overseas, who was this thing called the DASA report, known as the NHS Next Stage Review. So a report commissioned by the NHS, UK government, 2007, and it was to lead how to improve the NHS, including change with governance structures. And then from in general healthcare, governance has structures and processes to ensure the accountability, transparency, effective decision making of healthcare organisations. This could inform the kind of the board structures, regulatory frameworks, and quality improvement processes. With eMERTs, really, what do we do? I know we have the monthly clinical governance days, M&M mortality and morbidity meetings, and these were just there to establish that and review deaths as part of our kind of professional learning, to provide boards an assurance that patients aren't dying because of unsafe clinical practices. And from there, then, for example, in Wales, we have one of our lead consultants would kind of review and take lead of M&N, make sure that people are being honest, open to criticism, but they feel that they can be openly challenged and have feedback and have self-aware of what they did and how it affected the patient. And then on the other hand, then as well, you've got the person who is in sitting in an M&M thinking that, do you have this whole idea of being the type of psychological safety, having that environment where you can admit your own mistakes or your weaknesses, have constructed discussions and debate about other people's opinions of how they would potentially work on that case. So they're meetings which are there to inspire kind of changes and improvements to patients' care. And then with that effort, they make sure that these meetings are there to explore new ideas and new change of potential SOPs or things that we should do slightly different. And then out of those meetings as well, we have different things like I've got an airway group, we have a pharmacy group as well. So these kind of boards within our system, which kind of constantly kind of review techniques, equipment, to make sure that the whole kind of governance piece comes all together.
So just looking at that, an essential part of the governance piece really is the sort of the cold analytical case review and indeed the sequential decision making. But another part would be the hot debrief. Tom, could you maybe speak to the culture of debrief which has emerged through paramedic practice and indeed how that looks now, if there's any tools that you use and how frequently it's used within practice?
Yeah, I think we do use it. I think at the moment, the tempo of our work and the kind of pressures that are on us, it means it probably doesn't get utilised as much, because finding the time is an important bit for that, for both, hot and cold kind of debrief. But learning is one of the things that we always kind of look to do, and that's across multidisciplinary teams as well. It's not just the clinicians involved in the critical care kind of aspect in terms of pre-hospital. You place that into kind of the major trauma networks, and then it becomes, you know, major trauma network has their own clinical governance reviews, and that gets split into specialities, whether that's pediatrics or adults. The debrief with the ambulance service in the station after a job is one thing. And then, you know, there's a number of tools, as you're kind of well aware, and probably more of an expert than I am in that kind of matter. So you're probably best placed to just go through that with some of the listeners. Well, kind of shirking that one off to pass the ball over to you. But, I know that's one of your areas of expertise. I think it's the amalgamation of not just case kind of reviews, it's the bigger, broader picture and how we bring that into play so we can see trends and we can spot trends. That's really quite important, because it can be kind of that micro kind of look at, have you kept your end-tidal CO2 at an acceptable level? Have you kept your blood pressures at an acceptable level? What are your times in terms of being able to undertake certain procedures? Are they within acceptable times, or your times on scene? That there's all of these things, which that's the kind of trend process. So you've got to take all these aspects and kind of bring them together. And I think on the kind of larger scale, you know, you've got some of the things that we're dealing with is from the public health kind of aspect. And I know you had Andrew Ferber on one of your podcasts the other day talking about, actually, we have a wealth of data. And how do we use that in terms of looking at solutions? At the kind of primary, secondary and tertiary points that you can intervene with kind of public health. That role will come to us at some point. It'll be interesting to see whether new career pathways come off from how we review data and how we look at things.
So, Mike, just looking at competency for a minute, I know you were speaking to just now about how you've had your core competencies mapped across from work into indeed your MSc. Could you maybe speak to what you perceive to be as competent and how that might be monitored and or recorded from a service perspective, and maybe indeed even from an MRTS perspective, how do they map across competence?
So some people might be aware that, you know, as a CCP, I've got an additional set of skills away from paramedic practice. I'm really lucky that I know I'm always working with another member of staff, either it's a doctor or more of a senior CCP like Tom. So this kind of allows me to have a large safety net underneath me all the time. Probably listeners are as competent as, you know, refers to the ability to perform tasks or skills effectively. And it depends on that skill or task that I think really depends on how you become competent at it. I can only go by my experiences that, you know, I came to EMERTS as an intubating paramedic, for example. I was off the back of another hemsocomb, and even though I thought I was quite competent at intubation, that skill, I had to go through the grueliest kind of training protocols that, you know, what EMERTS kind of laid down in front of me. I had to go through, you know, learning again, so going back to, you know, the hospital placements, doing it in front of the lead anaesthetics, the lead CCPs, and, you know, this was put forward to the airway group before my official sign-off. I had to be again a certain number of intubation in hospital, out of hospital. You know, as EMERTS, we've got a KPI, a key performance indicator of greater than 90%. So that's constantly reviewed. We have to have a logbook that we set, and that's been showed every year to our lead CCP as well. So I would say that EMERTS have got high expectations of staff to perform, really, but I do feel that we've had that support along the way to achieve this. So I think going back to the governance question, really, it's how that is kind of built into the whole system, and then with that competence and skill set.
So coming into land on the conversation, I just wondered if we could just look at a few questions before we do finish. Just one, if I could just get you to both speak to, maybe starting with Tom, just some of the salient aspects of practice that you've learned over time, or indeed that's become more apparent over time.
Yeah, sure. There's some quite kind of key trends which I think we'd all just kind of focus and recognize. One's the importance of, you know, every day's a learning day, every day's a school day. The emotional learning curve will take place throughout your kind of whole practice. I could give you a book, you can read it, but it doesn't make you competent. It's going out there, kind of seeing it, muscle memory and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of comes back then to a little bit of humility. We make mistakes, we'll always make mistakes. It's putting your hands up, recognizing it, and just improving yourself and improving the kind of others around you as well. And then that kind of stems from civility. We talk about civility saves lives within the kind of medicine, which comes down to one quote. And you said, I'm not allowed to swear, but it's so true. It's just don't be a dick. That's probably a motto within our unit. And I think it's something that everybody abides to. And that really kind of gives you that level playing field, flattened hierarchy, and all those things you talk about in terms of CRM and human factors. It boils down to one thing, just be nice to other people.
And yourself, Mike?
Yeah, I think don't underestimate the power of mental preparation. The term self-efficacy of, believe you can, and you're halfway there. So, either if it's a certain call, for example, a 6-year-old who's got life-threatening asthma, all the way up to thoracotomy, for example, I always think about what I would do if I come across a presentation or a condition. And then it makes me think then about, the training and the preparation. I remember chatting to one of the consultants at London Hems about this, really. And, we go through our training there, pretty much knowing that during your secondment, you will be doing a thoracotomy. Other services, you might never see one done, for example. But I think even though when you don't expect something might happen or come to kind of land on your plate on a rainy Tuesday afternoon, I think if you kind of thought about a condition, a subset group of patients, makes you handle the scenario a lot easier, even if you have never done it before.
So as we come to land on the conversation, I wondered if we could just speak to some sort of take-home points, really, for listeners around the evolution of paramedic practice and indeed how it's maybe changed you as a clinician. Tom, if you could maybe speak to that initially, but around I know you've fully embraced higher education and work as a senior lecturer for Cardiff University, but could you maybe speak to some take-home points around how you indeed the profession has embraced higher education?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of think, to keep it kind of short, it's the evolution that we see within our own education and our own practice and our own research. So, we've got research journals now that belong to the profession, so to speak. And that's important because that's us looking at our own governance, our own practice. And that governance looks after ourselves as clinicians, but more importantly, looks after our patients and makes sure we're doing what's best available to us in terms of the evidence base and that we're implementing it in the correct way. So I think we'll see more and more of that. We see more and more of kind of paramedic background with PhDs doing innovative kind of research. And that's really important because that really is what it boils down to in terms of, for patient benefit. And we're taking ownership of that as a profession. Long may that continue.
And yourself, Mike?
Well, I think, why I'm here today, really, I would say, yes, surround myself with people who continue to get more out of you. So thank you for that. It doesn't matter what you've achieved, and there's always somebody who can squeeze more out of you, and you can always do more what you think you can. But then there's another side of that as well, that don't underestimate the power of the kind of negative inspiration as well. So years and years ago, you'd sit in the crew room and you might have a textbook from university, and you'll have a sarky comment about what you're doing, really. But then sometimes that kind of drives your inspiration, your motivation more. So yeah, that's me.
Listen, thank you both for your reflections over the past hour. It's been really informative, but also just journeying through the past sort of evolution of paramedic practice is fascinating from a UK perspective. Many thanks for your time and indeed your perspectives. Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.